Back in the late 1980s, Pope John Paul II directed the Vatican's Commission for Religious Relations with the Jews to examine the church records and determine whether or not the church was responsible for the deaths of European Jews during World War II. This review took 11 years. The answer came in March of 1998, and the position of the church was no. They argued that modern anti-Semitism was more sociological and political than it was religious, and therefore the church was not responsible for the Holocaust. At about the same time, the church also opened its archives to independent scholars so they could go and look at the material and make a conclusion for themselves. And this morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll talk with a scholar who did just that. His name is David Kurtzer. He's professor of social science and anthropology and Italian studies at Brown University. He's the author of The Kidnapping of Edgardo Mortara, a book that was a finalist for the National Book Award. And he has authored a new book, which is titled The Popes Against the Jews. The subtitle is The Vatican's Role in the Rise of Modern Anti-Semitism. It's published by Knopf's. And his conclusion is, in fact, the church does play a role here. It has been responsible in promoting anti-Semitism and feels that there is ample evidence for that and can be found in the records of the church. All of this in the new book, and it is in the bookstores now if you're interested. But also, of course, here we're open to your thoughts and questions and comments as we talk with David Kurtzer about his book. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you're here locally where we are, the number to call 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, if you match the numbers and letters, you get WILL, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. At any point, people are welcome to call. All we ask of callers is that they just try to be brief so that we can get in as many people as possible. Professor Kurtzer, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
What your reaction when the church in 1998, when the Catholic Church announced that after these many years of reviewing this question, that it was the feeling of the church that it was not responsible in any way for the Holocaust, for the deaths of European Jews in World War II? What was your reaction when you heard that?
Well, it was disappointment because we should first of all distinguish, because since certainly the Second Vatican Council in the early 1960s, the Church has dramatically changed its position with regard to the Jews, has eliminated anti-Semitic references from its liturgy and from its catechism, has worked very hard with Jewish leaders to bring about ecumenical understanding, and certainly the current Pope, John Paul II, has been a real leader in trying to bring about better relations with other religions, including the Jews. However, there continues to be a problem in the church, apparently, and particularly at the highest levels of the church, with willingness to confront its history. And it's what I take to be an uncomfortable past. That is the fact that, indeed, the Vatican, at the various highest levels, including the popes, played a significant role in the rise of modern anti-Semitism of a sort that conditioned huge numbers of Europeans to demonize the Jews, to view the Jews as a mortal threat to them, and in that sense to prepare the way for the Holocaust. This, however, is not to say, obviously, that the Holocaust was produced by the Catholic Church. That would be ludicrous. It was produced by the Nazis, who were also anti-Catholic. But the German population, the Austrian population, other populations throughout occupied Europe had a demonic view of the Jews that had been inculcated in them in significant part by the Catholic Church in those areas where the Catholic Church was dominant. Mm.
And just, again, I don't want to put too fine a point on this, but here we are talking about what had been the official position of the Church, not certainly what its current position is, but I think in the book you do, in a very direct way, say that as you have, that while, in fact, even then the Church might not have approved of killing of Jews, teachings and actions of the Church helped to make it possible.
Well, that's right. If you look at the Vatican report you mentioned that came out 3 years ago, they identify the beginnings of modern political anti-Semitism as taking place in the last two decades of the 19th century. And so in my book, I look particularly at those centuries as well as more recent ones to see how did those parties get started and what role did the Catholic Church play. And in fact, I find that behind the scenes, the Catholic Church, the Vatican, and the Pope himself played a significant role in helping promulgate those parties. And at the same time, something that really flabbergasted me was that into the 20th century, the Vatican was still accusing Jews of ritual murder, that is, promulgating the view that Jews were required by their religion to murder small Christian children as painfully as possible, drain them of their blood, which they gave to the rabbis, according to these Vatican publications, and use for their Passover matzah. Well, I mean, this kind of demonization of the Jews is exactly which led to the kind of hatred that would have such lethal consequences in the not-too-distant future.
Mm-hmm. And just, again, to make sure people are clear what we're talking about here, we're talking about this, the Church was perpetuating this belief into the 1900s.
Yes, that's right.
And in what, how directly was it doing that? In what sort of format was it? And was it really open and above board and right out there? No doubt that the Church, in an official sort of way, was saying that Jews indeed did this.
Well, it took various forms. The for example, the press, the Catholic press. There are two newspapers that are essentially directly under Vatican control and were back then. They both still exist today. One is the daily newspaper of the Vatican, which is called the Roman Observer, L'Osservatore Romano. And the other was a biweekly put out by the Jesuits, but under direct Vatican supervision. They reviewed each issue before it went to press. And that's called Civiltà Cattolica. Both of them, beginning in the 1880s, began to run long, vicious anti-Semitic articles which accused the Jews not just on religious grounds. You mentioned that distinction that was made in the Vatican Commission's report of 3 years ago, but on economic grounds, on social grounds, on political grounds, in other words, on all the grounds of that were to underlay modern anti-Semitism. So the Catholic and specifically the Vatican press played a major role. Secondly, there were new parties, new anti-Semitic parties getting started in Europe in the late 19th century. The one that was probably most important is called the Social Christian Party in Austria. And there, the leaders of the Austrian government were very concerned about the virulent anti-Semitism of this church-backed party and the kind of anti-Semitic rallies and violence that were resulting from it. And they brought in the papal nuncio, the papal representative to the Austro-Hungarian Empire in Vienna, and begged him to prevail on the Pope to rein these people in, or at least if he failed to do so, to sever the ties with the Vatican. And one of the things I found in my work in the Vatican archives was the secret correspondence between the Vatican nuncio in Vienna and the Pope and the Secretary of State in the Vatican, where I could retrace how, in fact, the Pope and the Vatican protected the Christian Social Party and rejected the notion that it was doing anything wrong. A third example, talking now about into the 20th century, would be the Inquisition and the ritual murder charge. One thing that you should realize is that there were voices high up in the church against the anti-Semitic campaign of the Vatican, and that did try to get it changed, and this was true for well over a century. With these charges that Jews were murdering Christian children because they were commanded by their religion to drink their blood, the archbishop in charge of the Catholic Church in England wrote a protest to the Pope at the end of 1899, saying, this was a protest that occurred after the Vatican Daily newspaper issued yet another article charging what they called Judaic ritual murder, and called on the Pope to do something about it. The Pope referred the matter to the Holy Office of the Inquisition, and those archives are now open for the first time. And there one finds that the cardinals who make up the Holy Office of the Inquisition totally believed in Jewish ritual murder and refer in a private note, which had never been published before, to the archbishop in charge of the Catholic Church in England as a dupe of the Jews. So these are just some examples to give you some notion of the kind of fronts on which this anti-Semitic battle of the Vatican took place.
Here at this point, perhaps I should introduce again the guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last little bit. We're speaking with David Kurtzer. He is Paul Dupré, Jr., University Professor of Social Science and Professor of Anthropology and Italian Studies at Brown University. He's the author of the book that we're talking about here this morning, which is titled The Popes Against the Jews, subtitled The Vatican's Role in the Rise of Modern Anti-Semitism. It's published by Knopf. He's also author of an earlier book that got a lot of attention titled The Kidnapping of Edgardo Mortara, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. That book tells this story of a Jewish boy who was taken from his family because a Christian housekeeper, I think, somebody who was working in the household, said that she had secretly baptized Edgardo, and then it was the position of the church that now he was Christian and couldn't be living in a Jewish household. And the local inquisitor ordered that the family, that he should be taken from his family. And I was really struck by your mention in the introduction to the book that one of the reactions that people had to this was, and this took place in 1858, they say to you, "You mean there was still an Inquisition in 1858?
Yes, in fact, that's a common reaction. And the Inquisition lasted really until the beginning of the 20th century. But what differed was that after the fall of the Papal States, the last part of which was Rome, fell to the unified Italian kingdom in 1870, the Vatican no longer had police powers. So that cases like the one you mentioned of Edgardo Mortara, the six-year-old Jewish child taken from his family on orders of the Inquisitor, could no longer happen because the Inquisitor didn't have the power to call on the police to take violent action like that.
You start actually in the 19th century at talking about what had been the case before Napoleon and after, the fact that when Napoleon was defeated, 1814, and there was the restoration of the Papal States, that is the area that had been controlled by the church before Napoleon was again controlled by the church, that this would have been an opportunity to take a more progressive kind of stand as far as relations between Christians and Jews were concerned. And in fact, instead of doing that, what the church did was reinstate the policies that had been in effect before: ghettos for Jews, other restrictions, and remarkably enough, requiring them, as it had in the past, to wear a yellow badge on their clothes indicating the fact that they were Jewish.
Yeah, so you're talking about people being surprised there was still an Inquisition as recently as the 19th century. Well, another thing people are surprised by is that forcing Jews to wear the so-called Jew badge, forcing them to live in ghettos, removing them from public schools, from any jobs other than the lowest jobs, separating them from Christians. These were, which many people identify as measures introduced by the Nazis as part of the leading up to the Holocaust, these were actually all measures that were enforced by the Vatican as long as the Vatican had police powers over the Jews, which, as I mentioned, lasted as late as 1870 in the case of Rome. But there's something else you mentioned that I think is very important and illustrates the point we were talking about a little before. That is that at the same time as these strict and anti-Semitic measures were taking place, there were voices high up in the Vatican for a more humane position and saw the dangers and the inhumanity of the Vatican's Jewish policy. The most important and the greatest statesman in the church in modern times, Cardinal Consalvi was the Secretary of State of the Vatican when restoration took place, that is, in the beginning of 1814. And among the documents I found for my book is something that had never been seen before, namely letters from Consalvi, which report that he argued strenuously with the Pope, who was then Pius VII, arguing that the Jews should not be put back in the ghettos and all the old restrictions reintroduced, that those were vestiges of medieval times that the church needed to adopt to modern times. And he, unfortunately, was, because it could have led to a whole different history of church-Jewish relations and possibly, who knows, even affecting later developments with the Holocaust, He was overruled by the Pope, who was under great pressure by the other cardinals of the Curia, who thought that the church position on the Jews was one that was divinely ordained and therefore could not be changed. The argument that it's not in keeping with modern times, they totally rejected because they thought it sprung from divine truth, and that never changed.
Well, in those areas in which the church could exercise this authority, what sort of restrictions were placed on Jews?
Well, Jews in the Papal States, now the Papal States consisted of a swath of territory that ran roughly from Rome up through Ferrara and Bologna in central northern Italy. And in those areas, Jews were only allowed to live in one of eight ghettos. They weren't allowed to live anywhere else in the Papal States. The ghettos had walls and had doors. The Jews were locked in every night by a Christian doorkeeper, whom the Jews were required to pay. And they were not allowed to practice most occupations. They were not allowed to go to school. They were not allowed to teach Christians. To travel, they needed special permission, and only for a short period of time normally were they given that permission. And generally, it was regarded they were regarded as a dangerous influence, and all contact with Christians should be reduced to a minimum. This was the Vatican's position.
I think it's one of the things that's really striking here is when we see the attitude that the church hierarchy took when we get to the point where they no longer had this authority, where finally, I think, as you said, in the 1870s, the last place they had that kind of authority was in Rome, and then they even didn't have that anymore. I think it's very striking that, in a time now when we're talking about anti-modernism being a force abroad in the world, that it was really anti-modernism embraced by the church, particularly, I think, in the person of Pius IX, anti-modernism mixed with a very healthy portion of modern anti-Semitism that was operating here.
Yes, in fact, you're right. I mean, when lately, since September 11th, unfortunately, it's heard a lot about groups that are unwilling to come to terms with, not only unwilling to come to terms with modern times, but seeing it as the enemy. And in the case of the church, there was a rejection of modernity. You mentioned Pius IX in the 1860s. He issued the famous Syllabus of Errors, which specifically denounced modern times, denounced the notion that there should be separation of church and state, denounced the notion that there should be freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press. And one of the interesting things to happen that's discussed in the book is that when the Pope loses his temporal power, loses his political power, there's a transformation in the mentality in the Vatican where this rejection of modernity sort of transmutes into a rejection of the Jews in a new way. Back when the church had power over the Jews to keep them in the ghetto, that was one way of dealing with them, but they weren't really seen as a major threat most of the time. But now that the Jews were released from the ghettos, the rejection of modern times came to be identified with the Jew who was seen, interestingly, the main enemy was not seen as the Orthodox, the very religious Jew, but the so-called secular Jew, who seemed to embody the principles of modernity, who gained from the freedom of religion, from freedom of speech, freedom of movement. It was the Jews. So the Jews became identified with modern times and became seen by the Vatican as the enemy.
Something else that we hadn't touched on, and we talked about various kind of restrictions placed on Jewish life in the Papal States, in this period here, say from 1814 up into the 1870s, requirement that they wear this insignia identifying them as Jews, the fact that they could only live in the ghettos that they were locked in at night. Also, something that the church was involved in at the time was forced conversion. They actually went into the ghettos, taking women and their children out, telling the women that if they didn't convert, that they were going to keep the children and they would never see their children again.
Yes, that's something else that I think was totally unknown until I discovered an archive that had these records there. These forced conversions, though, happened under particular circumstances. Looking at this period when the church reasserted its control in Rome right after 1814 and up till it lost its power in 1870, I found a really striking pattern. There's an institution that the church had established back in the 1500s for converting the Jews called the House of the Catechumens. And what you had beginning in 1814 is a stream of young Jewish men who, for various reasons, interesting reasons, went voluntarily to the House of the Catechumens to explore the possibility of converting, which of course would give them, liberate them from the ghetto, give them access to regular employment and so on. And what I discovered was that when they came in the door and met with the priest in charge, the rector, the first thing after asking whether they had come to explore conversion, the first thing they were asked or told really was that they were required to pledge their wife and children for baptism as well. And that same night, in all these cases, and there were scores of these cases, the police would be sent into the Roman ghetto where Rome's 5,000 Jews lived and forcibly extract the wife and children of the man who had come into the House of the Catechumens. Now, as you mentioned, what's particularly chilling about this is that the small children were immediately baptized. And so the parents, and particularly in this case the wife who was brought in forcibly, was told if she ever wanted to see her children again, she would have to be baptized herself and renounce her Jewish identity, leave the ghetto, and take up a Christian life.
We have a couple of callers. We're at our midpoint already. Maybe I should just real quick again introduce our guest. We're speaking with David Kurtzer from Brown University. He's professor of social science, also anthropology and Italian studies. He's the author of the book, The Kidnapping of Edgardo Mortara, which was a finalist for the National Book Award, and his new book is titled The Popes Against the Jews, the subtitle The Vatican's Role in the Rise of Modern Antisemitism, published by Knopf. We have a couple of people here. The number, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in to start out with in Normal, line number 4, right here. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I just came in on the conversation and at the point where you were mentioning Pius IX. And from what I've read, Pius IX started his pontificate as a very liberal pope and then gradually deteriorated into what he became. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yes, you're absolutely right. Pius IX became pope in 1846, following a rather reactionary pope. And in Italy, there was great jubilation because Pius IX, who was a very affable man and in some ways a down-to-earth kind of man, very approachable, was seen as somebody who would change the Vatican's position and, in particular, who might reconcile the unification of Italy, because at the time Italy was divided into many different states, including the papal states, and the big issue of the time in Italy was to unify Italy in one single country. 2 years later, there were the revolutions broke out in 1848 throughout Europe, and as a result of these revolutions, the Pope, Pius IX, fled the papal states, and the people like Mazzini and Garibaldi took over, pronounced the end of the papal regime. But the Pope called on the French and Austrians to send in their troops, which they did, which restored him to power. So this was the traumatic event for Pius IX that really changed him from a relative liberal progressive to someone who saw only dangers in the new movements of modern times and did all he could to try to oppose them.
Was it purely because of the fact that he was about to lose the papal states?
Well, yes, that was a major part of it, because it had been the position of the Church, and would be for many decades after this, that the Pope could not rule spiritually without also having temporal power, that is, without having a kingdom of his own to protect him and protect his ability to enact his spiritual functions.
But then I think after that, after he lost the papal states, then at that point the doctrine of infallibility was pronounced, and that restored his, what would you say? I don't know what you would say, his ability to rule or whatever.
Well, you're right. He in 1869 convened the First Vatican Council, and the main agenda item was his program to have the Pope pronounced infallible, which had not previously been official Church doctrine. There was quite a struggle because there were many bishops who were not enamored with the notion of papal infallibility, but he prevailed, and papal infallibility was announced just literally weeks before he lost his temporal power to rule in Rome.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's go on to a caller in Belgium, Illinois here, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I was going to ask your guest as to whether in his studies he found the positions that the papacy takes on Islam. Not that I'm any scholar of it all, but they don't seem to have a real strong, high regard for Islam either.
Well, again, it depends on the period you're talking about. There, of course, there was a rejection. Now, if we're talking about the 19th century, a rejection of pluralism altogether. The notion that people could find their way to God through other religions was absolutely abhorrent to the Vatican and to the Church. And in some ways, the Jews and the Muslims shared a similar fate. For example, I had mentioned earlier this institution created for the Jews back in the 1500s. Called the House of the Catechumens. Well, I was using a kind of shorthand because although Jews were about two-thirds of the people who were brought there, one-third were Muslims. And so there were attempts to convert Muslims. And one thing, of course, about the church position was that it didn't matter what you had been. You could have been Jewish, you could have been Muslim, you could have been a pagan. Once you were baptized, you were occupied by the Holy Spirit and you were a Christian and should be treated as a fellow Christian. Of course, more recently, the Church has, as part of its more general ecumenical movement, has reached out to the Muslim world as well.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions, comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have that toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Back at the beginning of the program, I talked about the fact that when the Commission for Religious Relations with the Jews in 1998, after having spent something like 11 years reviewing this, came to this conclusion that modern anti-Semitism was something that was more sociological and political than religious, and so for that reason, they're saying, arguing the Church was really not responsible for it. However, it does seem to be the case that the Church was involved in the rise of political anti-Semitism, certainly in Austria, with the Social Christian Party there. You devote a chapter to that. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, the Christian Social Party was part of a larger movement, namely suffrage. The vote had been given to wider and wider segments of the population in Europe, and so you have the beginning of mass political parties. And conservative parties and other kind of demagogic and populist parties found that one of the easiest ways to attract enthusiastic popular following often was to use anti-Semitism. So in that sense, the Christian Social Party, which had as its leader a famous demagogue, Karl Luger, used this anti-Semitic card, if you could call it that, to generate mass following. Luger was the idol of the lower clergy in Vienna. On his 50th birthday, 500 priests of Vienna sent him warm wishes. Curiously, though, and although, as I mentioned earlier, he had papal backing, the hierarchy of the Church, that is, the bishops and archbishops in Vienna and in Austria, were very concerned about him. They saw him as a dangerous demagogue, and not least because they were afraid of some of his suspected socialist sympathies. So it wasn't only the government of Vienna that called on the Pope to renounce the party, the Christian Social Party, and its anti-Semitism. It was also the church hierarchy itself who did. Now, in other countries of Europe, the situation was somewhat different. There's the famous Dreyfus case, for example, in the 1890s in France. Alfred Dreyfus was a Jewish captain in the French army. He was falsely accused and then framed for selling secrets, military secrets, to the enemy, and sent to Devil's Island. When it became clear that the whole thing had been a frame-up, it was the Catholic press, and particularly one order of priests, the Assumptionist Order in France, that led a really rabid anti-Semitic campaign, profiting from the fact that the Vatican press continued to promulgate the view that Jews, wherever they were found, were never loyal to their own country. You can read in Vatican publications of the turn of the 20th century that while a either a Protestant or a French or a Catholic in France could be French, a Jew in France could only be a Jew, and the same thing with Jews in Poland and so on and so forth. So this is some of the activity going on at the time.
We have another caller here, someone on a car phone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I wondered if you could comment some on, and this I realize is a little out of your purview, but on the difference between the Roman Catholic response to Jewish population, what have you, and the Orthodox one in the East.
Well, it would depend a bit on the period.
Certainly.
Yeah, so if when we're talking, the problem of anti-Semitism also does affect and did affect the Orthodox Church, depending exactly where you're talking about. In some cases, in fact, although the Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church was very much at conflict, they could agree on one thing, namely their negative attitudes toward the Jews. I think this was in the 19th century most dramatically on display at the Damascus ritual murder case, when in Damascus, a Catholic monk went missing. Actually, he was an Italian monk who had been living in Damascus, Syria, for quite a while. And his fellow monks immediately accused the Jews of the city, saying that he had last been seen in the Jewish area, and undoubtedly he had been murdered by the Jews to drain his blood, this ritual murder charge. Well, the result was many Jews were killed, many were imprisoned in the riots and the activities that took place right after it. But one of the things I found in the Vatican archives were various letters from Orthodox Christian hierarchy of that part of the world to the Vatican, expressing support for the Vatican's position that this was all the work of the evil Jews. So you do have some of these unfortunate examples in the past. The current situation I would know less about in terms of the Orthodox Church.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Chicago for its next person here, line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I just want to relate the experience of my father, who emigrated to this country from what is now part of the Ukraine, a small village in that area. He came here in 1905 from what was then Tsarist Russia. And he found widespread anti-Semitism there in that small village among the ordinary people there. As a matter of fact, on Easter, all the Jews locked themselves in their houses, and as these people were coming from church on Easter morning, they would inevitably throw rocks at the homes of the Jews and break their windows. And this was an annual occurrence. Of course, in my own experience, here, born here in the United States, as a kid, I was always hearing references to Jews as Christ killers from among Irish Catholics. So it was a pretty widespread situation.
Well, that is one thing that did change with the Second Vatican Council, that the notion of Jews as collectively responsible and guilty for the death of Jesus, which had been very much a part of the Christian and Catholic view of the world, did finally change with the Second Vatican Council, so in the 1960s, and that notion of Jews as Christ killers was rejected. Of course, the part of the world, Ukraine, Poland, and so on, we've been hearing quite a bit about recently in this regard. Jan Gross had a book called Neighbors that came out earlier this year that's led to a huge scandal in Poland, because it shows that in a village in Poland, which had maybe 1,500 Jews and 1,500 Catholic Poles, that as the Nazis were approaching, but before they took over the village in the early 1940s, the Christians rose up against their Jews. The Jews had been living there for centuries, and massacred virtually everyone, the man, woman, and child. And this raises again the question of where could this kind of religious hatred come from? So this is part of a broader pattern, unfortunately.
We have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with David Kurtzer from Brown University. His book is out now. It's published by Knopf. It's titled The Popes Against the Jews, The Vatican's Role in the Rise of Modern Antisemitism. Questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. I think in recent years, the activities of the Pope during the war, Pius XII, has gotten a fair amount of attention. You would suggest, I think, though, that if there was one person, perhaps more than any other, who set the Church on the course that it took up to the war and perhaps through it, would have been his successor, Pius XI. His predecessor, Pius XI, who died in 1939. Tell us about him.
Yes, well, you know, there's been a tremendous controversy having to do with Pius XII and his so-called silence about the Holocaust during the war. And there have been a large number of books, including a number of bestsellers. There's been the famous play, The Deputy, which came out in the 1960s, which helped trigger all this. And there's still many books coming out on the subject. My own view is that the obsession with this particular issue is somewhat misplaced. I mean, it's not an unimportant or insignificant issue, but it pales in comparison if the question is, how could the Holocaust have occurred, to the larger question of how the European population could have been prepared to view the Jews as in the demonic ways that would allow them to massacre Jewish children and so forth. And part of the debate over the Pius XII involves comparing him unfavorably with his predecessor, Pius XI, who is seen in this view as the good pope, the pope who was really humane and so forth. And one of the things I found in the archives was a view of Pius XI as becoming pope, having the same ingrained, severely anti-Semitic views as the other popes had in previous decades and centuries. And seen from this point of view, what Pius XII did shouldn't, I don't think, be seen as a product of his own kind of individual personality and so forth, but as part of a much larger Vatican issue, which is how they viewed the Jews. And, for example, and most importantly, I think, what was it that laid the groundwork for the Holocaust? Well, it was in Germany, the Nuremberg Laws of 1935, and then in Italy, the 1938 so-called racial laws. These were the laws that took away all of the Jews' civil rights and resulted in them taking them out of public schools, firing all the Jews who worked in the public service, and so forth, quarantining the Jews. When this law was passed in Italy, in 1938, it's passed, of course, in Rome, right under the shadow of the Vatican. The Pope, who was well aware of them, had no objection except for one thing. In fact, the one thing he felt so strongly about that he did something very unusual for him, he tried to go over Mussolini's head and complain to the king. What did he complain about? Not the 98% of the laws that dealt with the Jews, but the other 2%, which involved the Jewish converts to Christianity, which according to the Italian racial laws were to be considered like Jews. And of course, from the Vatican's point of view, a Jew who had been baptized is now a Christian and should not be treated as a Jew. But to treat Jews that way was okay.
Another caller here. We'll go to Urbana, line one. Hello.
In reference to the source of the anti-Semitism, are you familiar with the medieval genre dealing with Jews? It's closely related to the Marian tales.
I'm not sure. Which genres did you have in mind there? Because there are various ones of them.
Well, the one I'm thinking of very often deals with the sacrifice of children, or at least the kidnapping of children. And sometimes they're actually part of the Marian tradition. Chaucer wrote one of them that appears in the Canterbury Tales, although he had probably never met a Jew at that time.
Chaucer, in fact, brings up the ritual murder charge.
And, yes, he does.
And the earliest ritual murder charges are from the Middle Ages in England, interestingly enough, before the Jews were kicked out of England. But I don't know about the relationship to the Marian devotion directly. So the ritual murder charge is a very old one, and from my point of view, the amazing thing is that it would still have credit in the Vatican early in the 20th century. there are other aspects of medieval ways in which Jews are depicted, and not just medieval, but also Renaissance. I was just in Bologna in Italy, for example, and they just, this is now a couple months ago, they just restored a church there, and the major artistic feature of this church, and this is today in Bologna, is a statuary which shows the scene of Mary having died, since you mentioned Marian devotion in this regard, Mary having just died, lying peacefully with various mourners with tears in their eyes around her, and appearing over her is someone identified as the Jew, who is holding a knife, and the legend says, and then above is an angel coming down, knocking down the Jew as he's trying to strike the body of Mary with a knife. And the legend says, the angel sent down to protect Mary from the Jews' desecration. So these kinds of images were very common and can still be found.
And apparently became very ingrained in European culture, I'm afraid. Is it true that the origin of that myth that Jews sacrificed children goes back to an early misunderstanding among the Jews of the Christian Eucharist? That they, in the second century, were charging that the Christians were sacrificing children.
Yeah, it turns out that the notion of ritual murder in one way or another is a very ancient one and goes back to pre-Christian times. Certainly, what's one of the ironies, of course, at least from a Jewish point of view, about the Christian ritual murder campaign against the Jews is, well, let me just, I can't resist. In 1914, the official Vatican biweekly Civiltà Cattolica, which is written by Jesuits and whose articles were approved by the Vatican before publication, commented on a recent ritual murder case and said that, in portraying the Jews' diabolical nature, the Jesuit author says Jews drink blood all the time, and in fact, he had found the Jewish text which show that Jews consider blood to be, and here I'm quoting, a drink like milk. Well, those people who are familiar with the Jewish dietary rules of being kosher and so on know that it is an absolute horror for blood, even animal blood. So the notion that Jews were drinking blood seems particularly odd. And the symbolism of imbibing the blood, of course, has a holy aspect in the Christian tradition in terms of the blood of Christ, obviously metaphorically, not literally. So yeah, there are many historical reference to that, and it's kind of a complicated history there.
And tell me again, when was that published?
That was published in the Vatican publication, Civiltà Cattolica, the Jesuit publication, in 1914.
Well, we're coming down to the point. We have a couple of minutes left. And again, I mentioned way back at the beginning of the program that that under the direction of the Pope, John Paul II, this Vatican commission reviewed the record, the Commission for Religious Relations with the Jews reviewed the records and said that they felt the Church was not responsible for the deaths of European Jews during the war, and then opened the archives so other scholars could you and other scholars could look at the record. And obviously you've come up with a very different conclusion. Has the Church made any kind of response to the work now that you've done?
Well, the only response has been to work, as I was doing it, the Italian version of this book, for example, isn't out yet, and I haven't gotten any Vatican response yet to the book, which has just been out a couple of weeks. A year ago, though, there was a big controversy about the beatification of Pius IX, and I was quoted in Italian media as saying that Pius IX referred in 1871 to Jews as dogs who, now that they were freed from the ghetto in Rome, were running through the streets of Rome barking and molesting the good people. The next day, a journalist at a Vatican news conference, the day before the beatification ceremony last year, asked about my quote, and the Monsignor from the Commission for the Making of the Saints of the Vatican said no serious historian put any credence in what I had to say about this sort of thing. And I referred him to the publication of the speeches of Pius IX put out by the Vatican itself, edited by a priest, and in the preface of which the priest mentions that Pius IX himself approved the draft of the book before its publication. And so, unfortunately, there does seem still to be a certain level of denial.
Mm. It is very clear in that particular case that you were quoting something that anybody, if they wanted to actually to go and verify it, would be easy for them to go.
Yes, in fact, I told this reporter who happened to be from Catholic News Services exactly where to find the book in the Vatican Library, and he emailed me back the next day and said he had in fact found it and thanked me for it.
Yeah. Well, I think we're about at the point that we're going to have to finish. What's important about all of this, do you think?
Well, I think they're both the specific and the general. The specific, I think, has to do with the relations between the Catholic Church and the Jews. And there's been huge progress made, as I mentioned earlier, but still there are some stumbling blocks, and certainly this probably is the major one, the Church's continuing inability to recognize its role in the oppression of the Jews in the past. And I think until that recognition occurs, it's going to be a festering sore, and I think not just for relations with the Jews, but maybe also within the Church more generally. I know some of my Catholic colleagues certainly think this. More generally, the whole question of how it is that religions can be used to demonize another people, I think, has tremendous importance for us in the world today, and we should be somewhat self-reflective about this, not just look out to the Islamic world or others, but also look into our own Judeo-Christian traditions and see how something like this could happen.
Well, Professor Kurtzer, I want to say thanks very much for being our guest today and talking with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Our guest, David Kurtzer. He is professor of social science and anthropology and Italian studies at Brown University. And if you're interested in reading the book that we have been talking about, once again, the title is The Popes Against the Jews, The Vatican's Role and the Rise of Modern Anti-Semitism. It's out just recently. It should be available in the bookstore, published by Knopf.